Minnesota, take home a story.
It's 6 minutes past 11. Today on Midday, it's the economy. I'm Mike Mulcahy, sitting in for Gary Eichten. University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff is hosting a gathering at the River Center in St. Paul today called the Summit on Minnesota's Economy. The issue at hand is whether Minnesota is at risk of falling behind when it comes to developing and keeping the kind of businesses that will create high-paying jobs into the next century. Just about everyone agrees the economy is great now. In fact, a major problem is how to find enough workers to fill the jobs that are available. But there have been concerns expressed about whether Minnesota is falling behind other states when it comes to creating the kind of conditions that allow companies, especially technology companies, to flourish. We're going to be talking with longtime St. Paul Pioneer Press business and economics columnist Dave Beal and University of Minnesota Professor of Economics Vivi Chari. But first, some background from our Minnesota Public Radio reporters. The University of Minnesota summit is happening in the midst of a vigorous debate about whether Minnesota is thriving or falling behind. Experts assessing the future of Minnesota's economy disagree over whether there's doom or zoom on the horizon. Minnesota Public Radio's Bill Catlin has the first of our two reports.
By one view, knowledge-driven, high-technology industries like software, medical technology, and telecommunications are key to economic success. One of the leading proponents of that view is Ross Duvall from the Milken Institute in California. Duvall says regions that lack a growing high-tech sector will be left behind.
It is playing such a large role in determining how well not only we are doing as a nation, but how regions of the country are performing.
Duvall issued a study last year ranking the Twin Cities 32nd in high-tech economic output. Rochester ranked 16th. The Twin Cities' low ranking in part reflects the eclipse of Minnesota's strength in mainframe computers by the PC and the Internet. In a more recent study, Duvall ranks Minnesota in the second or third out of four tiers in most of 13 categories affecting high-tech economic growth. Duvall says high-tech industries will determine an area's economic success because they're powerful growth engines.
Growth in high-tech industries has averaged somewhere between 20 to 25% per year, while the overall economy has been averaging close to 4%.
It's not just an academic debate. What's at stake is the size of paychecks, among other things. By one estimate, workers in industries producing information technology earned an average of $55,000 in 1998, 45% more than employees in IT-using industries. In Minnesota, a number of high-profile voices are raising concerns about Minnesota's future in an economy driven by innovation. They point to a declining share of national venture capital since 1995 and middling rankings for public stock offerings and new company growth. But others say Minnesota's economy has great strength regardless of its status as a high-tech center. Economist Arthur Rolnick of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis says one of the state's assets is the breadth of its economy.
The envy of many other communities, and like they have this kind of diversity so that you don't feel the economic shocks if a particular company should fail.
In Rolnick's view, even if the state's reputation as a tech center has eroded, the economy has done anything but. Minnesota has a very low unemployment rate. Personal income grew faster than the U.S. as a whole over the 1990s, boosting the state's ranking for personal income from 16th to 10th. And Rolnick says Minnesota has a high-quality workforce with a strong work ethic. He argues that's the key factor in economic prosperity, not high-tech.
It doesn't really matter which particular industry it is. We do well at what we do, and so that it's tough to anticipate which is going to be the next hot industry. In the past, we did well with supercomputers, for example. Currently, we're doing well in the medical industry. Right now, in other parts of the country, it may be high tech. I don't know if that's going to continue for 5 or 10 years.
Both sides marshal strong arguments for their views, and the disagreement extends to the high tech sector itself.
Our preference is to grow here in Minnesota. The issue simply is there are not enough high-tech workers here.
William Cadigan is CEO of ADC Telecommunications, a telecom and information technology firm and one of Minnesota's rising tech stars. In 5 years, ADC's global workforce has grown sixfold to more than 20,000. The company has deep roots in the Twin Cities, but Cadigan says the company's loyalty to Minnesota was not enough to overcome the realities of the state workforce.
Unfortunately, ADC had to take a very painful decision about 2 years ago to relocate one of our divisions based here in Minneapolis down to Dallas. And the reason for that was there were just not enough high-tech workers, again, engineers, software developers, to support that key initiative.
The Dallas operation now employs around 300, but Cadogan says the move will cost Minnesota 2,000 jobs over the long term. But not everyone agrees the situation is that grim.
What we've got is good engineers, and guess what they're out of in Silicon Valley is engineers.
Mac Lewis is a former tech company CEO turned venture capitalist. Lewis thinks Minnesota definitely has some catching up to do, but his firm, Sherpa Partners, is raising $40 million from investors to bet on emerging Minnesota technology firms. One of his selling points is Minnesota's stable, technology-oriented workforce. Lewis points out computer networking giant Cisco Systems this year cemented a partnership with one Minnesota firm and snarfed up a local startup for almost $500 million. And he says other West Coast tech firms are prowling the state.
They might like the product, but what they love to see is a group of engineers working together that they can put to work on market opportunities that they're trying to develop. So we're seeing companies outside of Minnesota coming in here and falling in love with our engineers and the talent we have here to build some new companies.
And that's not all. Minnesota's software industry has mushroomed. Government data suggests Minnesota's industry has grown nearly 250% since 1988, 43% more than the national average. Tom Stinson is the state economist.
I was frankly surprised. I knew that the software industry had been growing in Minnesota, but I didn't believe that it was growing that much faster than the national averages.
A portion of Minnesota's workforce in software is close to California's, and Minnesota's employment in high-tech industries is slightly higher than the national average. Even so, Stinson says there are clouds.
We don't have a particular advantage in terms of the number of high-tech professional workers, and that's a concern.
Stinson says engineers and scientists are more likely to generate the ideas that can spawn new companies. Just about everyone agrees on the need to ensure Minnesota has a skilled workforce. Stinson says that will be the key challenge, requiring more focus on existing workers and accommodating more immigrants.
We talked about the steps of compilation.
Warren Schaefer is helping his computer programming students through a problem at St. Paul Technical College. Most have jobs, and about half are from foreign countries. But Schaefer says technology poses the greatest challenge.
The disadvantage that our students have linguistically, say from foreign cultures, is secondary to the challenge that we face as students and faculty keeping up with the changing hardware and software. We're all struggling with that.
Keeping the workforce up to speed with technological change may be a huge challenge, but Ross Duvall of the Milken Institute says it's not the only one. He says strong regional economies require a top research institution that also has a pipeline for moving ideas from the lab to the marketplace. Lyle Ray of the Citizens League agrees, but he adds one more consideration, an aversion to complacency. Ray says the statistics indicate cause for concern, not panic, but he points out many other states have launched large-scale and heavily funded programs to boost the development of high-tech industries. Minnesota, he says, seems rudderless.
Complacency is probably worse than any single thing because you begin to sort of disregard and deny warning signs. And in Minnesota, we've been told we don't have gangs. We've been told we don't have all kinds of problems around here until it sort of hits us over the head with a brick. And I think that that kind of complacency denial tendency is very dangerous.
The trick, says Ray, is promoting a sense of urgency when times are good. He hopes one will emerge from the university summit. I'm Bill Catlin, Minnesota Public Radio.
With trade barriers crumbling, Minnesota's businesses are increasingly marketing their products to customers around the world. But just as the number of customers is growing exponentially, so is the number of competitors. Andrew Haig has our second report on what the state must do to ensure its future economic vitality.
It used to be that proximity to natural resources dictated industrial success. People took what grew or grazed around them, processed it, and sold it to customers near and far. Minnesotans had wheat. By the mid-1800s, the Roaring Falls of St. Anthony helped grind farmers' produce into flour. People from around the world soon developed an abiding appetite for the output of Minnesota flour mills. David Wiggins is a historian at the Minnesota Historical Society.
We were the focal point for the industrialization of food, and by making flour here in unheard of quantities at an unprecedented quality and exporting that all over the world. We changed how people related to farms all over the world. No longer was it possible to compete with the Minneapolis mills in Turkey.
By the late 1880s, Wiggin says Minnesota millers exported 35% of their flour abroad. Money flowed in from across the globe. But today, knowledge is the vital resource that companies and, indeed, whole economies must turn into industrial might. V.V. Chari is chairman of the economics department at the University of Minnesota.
As the level of competition increases, we're all forced, through the process of competition, to try and be the best that we can be at the particular job that we're doing.
It's the basic principle of international trade. Countries and states should focus on their competitive advantage. But in an information age, companies in Taiwan can do what firms in Minneapolis do, perhaps better. These days, why an industry sprouts here and not in Taipei may at times seem frighteningly arbitrary. Consider Medtronic, what's now a multi-billion dollar global medical technology powerhouse, began as a humble garage startup. If it weren't for one Earl Bakken and the University of Minnesota, where he studied, Minnesota might not have one of its most important corporations, as well as the roughly 8,000 medtech and healthcare companies that have sprouted around it to create a region known internationally as Medical Alley. Bill George is CEO of Medtronic.
I don't think we could have done it if we hadn't had the base support here from Minnesota, the high technology area we're in, the academic learning, the ability to attract high quality employees at all levels from production to R&D to marketing and sales to management.
George says Medtronic will add 1,000 to 1,200 new employees this year. And though labor is tight, he says the company won't have much trouble finding new talent. George says that's because Medtronic pays well. It may also be because people who want to work in medical technology come to Minnesota. Just like people who want to be stockbrokers often go to Wall Street. Medical Alley has become what economists call a cluster, a locus for a single industry. MedTech engineers may move to Minnesota because they know that whatever happens, there are dozens of companies hungry for their expertise. And medical technology investors who help fund the industry are comfortable putting their money in other similar companies because they know the risks and the rewards. The upshot of all this, customers from around the world look to Minnesota for medical devices, like people look to Idaho for potatoes. Again, the U of M's V.V. Chari.
The flip side of the statement that our competitors are across the world is that our markets are across the world. Then the size of our markets is vastly bigger than anything we ever dreamt of. And so therefore, if we're very good at doing something, then we have 6 billion people who come rushing to our door.
Minnesota companies are also leaders in manufacturing heavy industrial equipment, tiny electronic monitors, and sheet glass for skyscrapers. The state exported about $9 billion worth of manufactured goods last year. That's about 55% more than in 1990. By way of comparison, Minnesota exported about $2.4 billion worth of agricultural goods in 1998, according to the latest data available. That was 10% less than in 1997. State economist Tom Stinson says exports of products and services will become increasingly vital to the state's well-being.
Trade is crucial to Minnesota's economy, and it's going to be even more important as we look out into the future. And the reason why is we produce things that we sell to other people, and the growth in the demand for items that we produce is greater outside of Minnesota and greater outside of the U.S. Than it is internally.
Some say it's nice to be known for medical devices from Medtronic and sheets of glass from Marvin and Anderson Windows, but the state needs to become a nexus for high technology companies that sell things like software and telecommunications equipment. Some local business leaders say being located in Minnesota can sometimes be more hindrance than help. William Cadigan is CEO of ADC Telecommunications, which makes components that help information flow faster across fiber optic cables. He's among those who say Minnesota doesn't have a dynamic cluster of high-tech companies.
The issue of lack of critical mass causes a lot of people not to look at our state currently. If that issue were dealt with and we had a good mix of both large companies like ADC as well as an established group of startup companies, I think that would go a long way towards making ADC a more successful company and one that would further attract others into the state of Minnesota.
Not that ADC is doing badly. This year, its sales are expected to grow by 50% to about $3 billion. But in some ways, it's only nominally a Minnesota company. 75% of its 20,000 employees work outside the state, in places like Dallas and Silicon Valley. Cadogan says that's partly because the company can't find enough qualified workers in Minnesota. He says politicians, the University of Minnesota, and companies like ADC have to work together to promote high-tech business development. The tricky part is figuring out how to make the state a magnet for high-tech industries. Perhaps the best thing to do is encourage the spirit that built the Twin Cities in the first place. 100 years ago, the Riverside flour mills, even as they thrived, had to innovate to stay ahead. Milling engineers created increasingly sophisticated machines to manage the flow of water and flour. Financiers learned to utilize the flows of money that came rushing in. Again, the Historical Society's David Wiggins.
The millers here in the 19th century got very good at controlling these flows and using them to their advantage. And those skills in managing complex systems of flows are a terrific business asset as we look at the economy evolving towards less tangible things, information flowing around.
It may not be such a stretch, after all, to think of fiber optic cables as the rivers of yore. Success in the global economy will likely depend on harnessing their power. I'm Andrew Haig, Minnesota Public Radio.
You're listening to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Mike Mulcahy, sitting in today for Gary Eichten. We are going to continue our focus on Minnesota's economy with our guest today, St. Paul Pioneer Press business and economics columnist Dave Beal and University of Minnesota Professor of Economics V.V. Chari. The number to call if you want to join in our conversation is 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. Dave Beal and V.V. Chari, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. This is Chari.
Yes, sir. Dave, let me start with you first, if I could. What in general is the state of Minnesota's economy right now? It seems like when you drive down any street, you see help wanted signs. Things seem to be going fine. Why all this concern about the future?
Well, I think there's no doubt that it is one of the best, strongest state economies going today by the measures of personal income, which used to be below that of the U.S. and since 1982 has moved up past it and steadily gaining on it per capita income, by the unemployment rate, by the surpluses that the state has been piling up. It's done extremely well, and neighboring states, many states, wish they had what we have. This is about tomorrow, not about today. And we did a section on this on Sunday, which mentioned and cited the successes that we have had, but said that we have to be concerned about doing the kinds of things we need to do to be strong tomorrow. And the reason that we're strong today is that we did things 30, 40 years ago on everything from K-12 schools to the University of Minnesota, to roads and bridges, to build up a strong economy. And it's easy when the economy is as strong as it is today to sit back and not do very much and just be complacent.
And Professor Chari, is that pretty much the way you see it?
Very much so. Previous generations made some very wise investments, in particular in education, but also in constructing what at the time was an unrivaled transportation system. They devoted a lot of resources to the University of Minnesota, and we're thankful to them for doing it. And the thing that we've got to worry about is whether 40 years from now our children will rebuke us for not having made those kinds of investment decisions that our fathers and grandfathers and mothers and grandmothers had the good sense to make.
And what kind of specific investments should the state be looking at now, in your opinion?
Well, I think that the state, much of what the state has to look at and is education, training, and research. And these are the kinds of functions that government does get involved in and support that are not involvements that cut into the market activity that you could be expected to have of the private sector. But I think that a lot of leadership is needed in order to make the improvements, the progress that's needed on workforce development. One of the big discussions at the summit today on education, the University of Minnesota. There are real questions about, for example, the medical school, whose ranking is 27th now versus 14th in 1982. The general ranking of the university as a research university. And to the extent that we let the university slip as a great research university, we could well reduce the odds that it will be able to come out with the kinds of big ideas that eventually find their way into the marketplace and create jobs and value for the Minnesota economy.
And Professor Chari, would you agree with that?
In substantial part. I think that's the most important kind of public investment that we can make nowadays. Cliches have a nugget of truth, and a cliche of nowadays is that we're moving into a knowledge and information-based economy, and that certainly is true. And in a knowledge and information-based economy, institutions that create, foster, and disseminate knowledge are going to play an absolutely central role. So for good or for ill, the research institutions at the University of Minnesota, I think, are going to play a very, very big role in determining whether we are a prosperous state 20, 30, 40 years down the road.
But, Professor, aren't there others out there now who are saying that Minnesota is in fairly decent shape and there isn't this big problem looming? How do you respond to people who take that opinion?
There are some signs that we are not doing as well as we could in some high technology areas. This is in particular true for internet-oriented startup firms, which seem to play a central part in Silicon Valley or in Northern Virginia or in Austin. Or on Route 128 in Boston. Those are areas that seem to be doing much better in this particular industry. Now, this is not to say that, you know, we should have our finger in every industry in the world, but it's that kind of, you know, you always have a nagging sense that maybe we're not doing what's quite right, and so therefore maybe we'll fall back. So I don't think it's time for a call to cry to arms, we've got to do this, that, and the other. It's a time for some sober reflection, trying to make sure that we've got our, we've got a well-diversified portfolio of industries and we've got a well-trained workforce.
V.V. Chari is a professor of economics at the University of Minnesota. We're also joined in the studio today by Dave Beal, business and economics columnist for the St. Paul Pioneer Press and lead writer of that special section in the Pioneer Press last Sunday about the future of Minnesota's economy. We invite you to join our conversation as well. How do you think Minnesota's business climate is doing, and what should the state do to prepare for the future? You can give us a call at 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Anywhere else you can hear our conversation, please join in toll-free, 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. And we will just take a short break now and get back to our conversation in just a minute.
On Sound Money this week, we look at ways to overcome debilitating debt. This is Chris Farrell, and my guest will be Joy Thormudsgaard from the National Foundation of Credit Counseling. How do you know when you're in trouble, and where do you go for help? We'll find out on Sound Money, Saturday morning at 10, again Sunday afternoon at 5 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Programming on NPR is supported by the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board in Eveleth, facilitating business development in northeastern Minnesota.
And Greta Cunningham is standing by in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. Greta?
Good morning, Mike. The White House Independent Counsel has concluded there is insufficient evidence for any criminal charges against President and Mrs. Clinton. Robert Ray has wrapped up his six-year investigation into the Clintons' business dealings in Arkansas. The investigation cost taxpayers more than $50 million. The Senate Commerce Committee has approved a bill that would require car makers and their suppliers to reveal more safety information. Under the measure, the companies would have to share more data with the federal government. The bill also boosts penalties for those who hold back key information. The bill goes before a House panel tomorrow. The legislation comes in the wake of a major tire recall by Bridgestone Firestone. Congressional investigators say they've uncovered testing done by the company in 1996 that showed problems with the tires now under recall and linked to dozens of traffic deaths. In regional news, North Dakota Democratic gubernatorial candidate Heidi Heitkamp says she has lymph cancer. Heitkamp says she will have to curtail her campaign schedule, but is not quitting the race. She says she'll have more tests over the next few weeks. She says at this point it would be premature to make any decisions about the campaign. A group of officials who met today say Minnesota's election laws are too complicated for the average person or a new candidate to understand. The group wants to make the process simpler. An attorney with the Secretary of State's office says voters don't know where to go when they have a question about election law. The group will meet over the next few months to come up with ways to streamline the information and make it more clear where people should go to find answers. The roundtable is made up of lawmakers as well as representatives from the offices of the Secretary of State, Attorney General, Campaign Finance, and Public Disclosure Board, and others. The meetings are being organized by Common Cause Minnesota. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for a chance of showers statewide. It will be windy in the north today with high temperatures ranging from 48 in the northeast to around 60 in the south. Checking conditions around the region, Rochester reports clear skies and 54 degrees. Skies are cloudy in St. Cloud and 53. And in the Twin Cities, partly cloudy skies, a temperature of 55 degrees. Mike, that's a look at the latest news.
Thank you, Greta. We are continuing our discussion about the state of Minnesota's economy and how to keep it strong into the future. We're doing it because there's a summit being held in St. Paul today, the Summit on Minnesota's Economy. Our guest in the studio, Dave Beal, longtime business and economics columnist at the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Racking up the minutes on his cell phone, University of Minnesota Professor of Economics, V.V. Chari. And we are joined now by University of Minnesota President Mark Udolph, who started this whole thing by calling this summit today. President Udolph, thanks for being with us.
It's my great pleasure.
I suppose a skeptic might look at this discussion and at your summit and say, well, the economy's fine and Udolph is just trying to get more money out of the legislature for the University of Minnesota.
Well, you know, there are two things I suppose I'd say. I think it's virtually a non sequitur. If the economy is bad, you fix it, but if the economy is good, it can get better. And I don't think Medtronic or Target says we're doing well, and but there's no way we could be more efficient or more consumer-oriented or whatever. So I think, you know, this idea that it's not worth doing unless there's a referendum on how well the economy is doing is wrong-headed. Even if it's doing great, the question is, can we make it better? Can we anticipate the future? On the question of the university, there are lots of stakeholders. If taxes go down, business will profit. There's better retraining programs, and labor will profit. And surely if you invest more in research and development, the university will profit. But I think I've been pretty transparent. Whenever people say you're a little bit biased, I said, no, you're wrong. I'm a lot biased. And so everybody's a stakeholder. So this idea that you look for the improper motive or that if the economy is fairly rosy, we just sit on our laurels and don't worry about it, I think, you know, both of those are not the right way to head.
President Udolph, Dave Beal, Governor Ventura, in his talk this morning, challenged the University of Minnesota to bring more ideas, set up, do more to encourage entrepreneurism and bring more ideas to the point where they can get out to the marketplace. What are you doing in that regard, and can you do more?
Well, I think, Dave, it's like I was saying, actually we're doing pretty well. You know, we have 60 patents this year, which is up, and our research funding is up by 25%, and we are spinning more ideas out and licensing them and so forth, but I think we could do a whole lot better. So I accept the governor's remarks in the context of we can all do better, that if the University of Minnesota did twice as much research and spun off twice as much technology and started more companies than it does today, that the state would be much better off. So I accept all that, and I thought the governor was being quite constructive.
Do you see any public universities, land-grant universities out there that are doing it as well as anybody? I mean, are there any models out there?
Well, there are some. I think the first ones that come to mind are all private. Dave, you know that, Columbia, MIT, and places like that. I think of Wisconsin as doing very well in this area, and Berkeley is doing very well. But there's not a one-size-fits-all. But we've made a lot of changes recently. You don't see that show up until subsequent years, but we've added a lot of people to our tech transfer group. We're now running seminars for the faculty on how to do startups and where to get advice. And I think there's some possibilities of what is called seed capital, that is really small grants, to help an idea move along to a product. So I think there's some good things in the offing, and there are some models out there, but frankly, the privates have greatly exceeded what the publics have done.
And President Udoff, will you have a specific request to the legislature this coming session to address some of these issues? And if so, can you tell us what some of those are?
Well, I will be announcing later today that I feel like I've done most of my job by focusing attention on these issues and bringing the people together. And no one appointed me czar, and we have a governor and a legislature. So what I've done is appoint a group of 21 people, and appoint's probably the wrong word, ask them to serve, and they're really an all-star cast, and to come back in 60 days with some proposals that would then be forwarded to the people of Minnesota, the legislature, and the governor. And my suspicion is they'll focus on workforce development, higher education, taxation, rural development, and venture capital. So I'm about ready to pass the baton on this and ask what I consider a cast of really fine people across a broad array of interest in Minnesota to try to come up with some modest first steps in the next legislative session.
Well, President Udoff, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Pleasure, sir.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
University of Minnesota President Mark Udoff talking to us from the River Center in St. Paul, where his summit on Minnesota's economy is going on right now. And Professor V.V. Chari, if I could ask you, when we talk about workforce development, what specifically do we mean by that? I mean, certainly businesses, their biggest problem now is getting people to come to work for them. What kind of things could the university do in the short term to help with that?
Main thing the university can do to help with that is to do a good job teaching our students. That's the primary way that we do workforce development. We teach our students useful skills and abilities, and most important, we teach them how to adapt, how to change, how to accept and receive new technologies. So the university is actively engaged in the process of workforce development. Of course, as President Udoff emphasized, we have to do better and we can do better. And all throughout the university, we have a variety of initiatives on the way to try and improve the quality of undergraduate teaching. So that's the direct thing that we can do. The other somewhat more indirect way we help workforce development is that a lot of workforce development occurs in our community colleges. Many of the staff, the faculty in the community colleges, are graduates of the University of Minnesota, people who have gone to graduate school and so on at the University of Minnesota. So we're actively engaged in making sure that the quality of our graduate program is strong enough so that people who can go out and teach in the state college university system and also in community colleges do a first-class job.
Dave Beal?
I think a lot of what needs to be done in workforce development falls to the legislature and to the community colleges. Many of the community colleges have very good customized training programs. They need to do more and take the best of them and replicate them in working with business. The legislature needs to look harder at the many fragmented worker training programs that serve a relatively small part of the population. 85% of the population is going to still be in the workforce in the year 2005, yet lots of the jobs are changing. And in the smaller companies, mid-sized companies, they don't have the training programs that the larger companies have. And so the legislature has to get in there and hash out how they can make this system better, these programs better, and whether they need to cough up more money for those programs.
We're talking about the future of Minnesota's economy on Midday Today, and Mike joins us on the line. Mike, go ahead, please.
Several comments. One, I applaud President Udall's initiative in focusing on this issue, and I think it's great that he's doing it, and I appreciate his transparency as to his reasons, but nonetheless, I think it is extremely important. I think a couple things can be done to improve this economy for business. One is to lower the commercial and industrial real estate taxes in this state. They're the third highest in the country. Second is that the transportation issue has to be addressed. And light rail transit is not the solution. It is, despite the mythology that is out there, it is proven to be ineffective. It is the highest cost, lowest capacity transportation system that is out there. So that situation needs to be addressed. And lastly, this concept of smart growth that Ted Mondale and the governor have put forth, again, is a myth that at the end of the day will drive businesses away because it creates artificial boundaries and barriers that drive up costs of doing business in terms of prices for properties and for buildings and those types of things. And it also goes against where people want to live by trying to constrict them into certain areas, so that will hurt us in attracting employees to this state.
Okay,
lastly,
okay.
Would be a personal income taxes to help attract people to this state.
Lower Thank personal you. Income taxes. Cut taxes, you're saying?
Yes, lower personal income taxes.
Okay.
In addition to commercial real estate industrial taxes being
okay.
lowered.
Let's chew on those comments for a little while. Thanks for the call, Mike. Dave Beal, cut income taxes and property taxes on businesses. Improve transportation, but not with light rail, and forget about these efforts to contain urban sprawl.
Well, I'll take the tax part of it and deal with that. I'm less informed on the other aspects. The high commercial and industrial property taxes do need to be eased, and I think the Ventura administration is looking at that in its new tax plan, and credit them for that. They are very high. There's been some progress made in cutting them down. They do cause, in apartment housing, there's evidence that the high property taxes have prevented more affordable housing units from being built. And if there were a way found to ease that burden, probably more housing would go up. On the personal income tax, there is a debate that seems to be shaping up about whether to ease the personal income tax rate or the capital gains rate. And legislation is going to be introduced by two DFL legislators to propose a targeted capital gains cut. That's liable to be controversial. The reason to do that is mostly as a symbol to entrepreneurs to improve the tax climate for startups and emerging companies.
And I read in your paper on Sunday, 8% capital gains tax rate now in Minnesota. Only six states
have higher rates.
Higher than that.
But the federal capital gains tax rate is much higher than the state rates. There's real question and real difficulty in determining how much impact really that has. It's mostly a symbolic kind of a move, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Chari, our caller also mentioned that these efforts to prohibit urban sprawl or to contain urban sprawl will eventually work against the state. I don't know if you've looked at that at all, but certainly one thing you hear about is that people don't like to work in areas that where there is a lot of sprawl. People don't like long commutes.
Actually, the evidence on that is pretty clear, and the evidence on that is that contrary to what is often asserted, people do apparently like sprawl in the sense that they like to have homes with large yards and plenty of space for pets and children to play around in, and so on and so forth. So absent very stringent restrictions on people's abilities to build new housing, what we do see is sprawl. That's one thing that's worth keeping in mind. The second thing is that expansion of an urban area does typically doesn't actually lead to necessarily an increase in commute times. Sometimes it leads to a reduction in commute times.
Hmm.
What seems to happen is that firms, manufacturing firms, other firms, seem to follow people to where they work. And the most rapidly growing type of commutes are, in fact, cross-town, cross-suburb commutes.
Well, you do hear a lot of politicians, though. You did last year, trying to do something about this transportation issue and congestion in particular in the Twin Cities. Certainly we're not as bad as any larger metro area, Los Angeles or
Silicon Valley.
But there does seem to be a growing frustration over commuting or congestion or something going on. And I
absolutely
think,
no, there is no doubt that quite apart from the sprawl issue, commute times in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area have gone up quite dramatically. Gone up in substantial part because of things that Dave Beal was talking about earlier. Our incomes have gone up more rapidly than the national average. More people are working in Minnesota than anywhere else. And all of those trends have contributed to a fairly dramatic increase in automobile travel. At the same time, the amount we've invested very little in increased automobile infrastructure, road infrastructure, over the last 15 years or so. So when you combine kind of fixed capacity with increased demand, you're going to get increased congestion. So the caller is absolutely right that that's an important kind of public investment that needs to be undertaken. I share this caller's skepticism that that light rail is the answer. The studies I've seen suggest that it's not very cost effective.
Well, I guess this kind of brings up sort of a larger question in this whole thing, and that is, who are we really competing with? Are we competing with the other states? Are we competing with countries overseas? And it makes it kind of hard to nail down some of these problems when it's hard to tell where we would get these workers from and where we would get these companies from, isn't it?
It is hard, but it's not necessarily that hard. I guess I think about it as not necessarily competition. We are in the business now, as Alan Murray in his remarks at the summit emphasized, we are now in the business of, as the internet and as tariff barrier takes hold and as tariff barriers fall, we are in the business of selling to 6 billion people all across the world. And that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is there are 6 billion people who are eager to sell their goods to us. That's what globalization means. That's what increased trade means. So who are we competing with? We're competing with 6 billion people. Who are they competing with? They're competing with 6 billion other people. So I think that's the right perspective to take. The right perspective to take is to make sure that we're poised take advantage of these huge opportunities that are opening up.
I would have a somewhat different perspective on it. I do think place and leadership matter quite a lot, and I think you can look to some areas where leadership made them strong regional economy, had a big role in developing a strong regional economy. I would point to Atlanta developing as opposed to Birmingham over the last generation or two. Atlanta had strong leadership in racial progressive views toward racial integration, had education leaders, did a lot of things in Atlanta that weren't done in some other cities, and that's why Atlanta has emerged as it has. Now, you can argue on the other hand, and people do in Atlanta, they were too successful. I mean, they have done so much that the sprawl and the environmental problems have emerged as major problems and growth problems. So that's another side of it. But place and leadership sorting through work development, workforce development issues here and so forth, matters a lot. And that's one of the things the summit is about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear from another caller now. Jim is on the line from Matamidi. Jim, welcome to Midday.
Yes, my concern is that all of these options and ideas that have come out are sort of like the horse is already out of the barn. The technologies that we're experiencing today were developed by very imaginative and creative people. Yet in the schools now, for the grade schools and that, most of the classes that teach creativity and innovation and use of imagination are being cut in favor of sports and how to become a nice worker bee to take care of the present day technologies. As far as the taxes and all that jazz is concerned, that's immediate greed kind of factor, whereas the concept of developing people that are going to be creating the new technologies that we're going to need to advance, because as soon as we build a technology, it goes overseas and somebody can make it a lot cheaper than us, and to try to catch up with that is going to be just a futile effort, whereas we have to generate people that can create completely new technologies that we aren't even dreaming about now. And yet the courses, like I say, that teach children when they're at their most basic form, the courses that teach them how to use their imagination are being slashed left and right.
Okay, Jim, thanks. We're running a little short on time here, so we'll have to respond quickly to this. Putting too many eggs in the technology basket, I think that's sort of at the heart of the question there.
Well, I think he's questioning whether we're teaching kids the right things.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just what goes on in the schools, you know. It's also what they come home and watch on TV at night. It's whether their parents are encouraging them to study and take courses. It's a whole culture, and the schools are only a part of the culture. And I think we can. For example, in the high schools, students are universally encouraged, or very much encouraged, in Minnesota and other states to go to college, four-year college. Well, it's been mentioned, Vivi, I think, mentioned it, two-year community colleges in some cases do wonderful jobs, and people with two-year degrees can get very good jobs if they're in the right area, and so we need to remember that.
Professor Chari, I can give you about 45 seconds on this topic.
Well, creativity is really, really important, and America historically has been phenomenal at creativity. The caller is absolutely right that we should worry about whether we're losing our edge or not. To some extent, a lot of this stuff is a little bit overdone. Right? We have wonderful creativity programs like Odyssey of the Mind and so on, which people are coming up with. I'm not that worried that America is going to lose its edge in creativity. I am worried that we are not devoting the time of kind of attention and resources to our kids, but I think we ought to. Got to do a much better job on that.
Okay, and I think that's where we're going to have to leave it today. I do appreciate your joining us today, Professor V.V. Chari, Professor of Economics at the University of Minnesota. Also, St. Paul Pioneer Press business and economics columnist Dave Beal. He was the lead writer on the Pioneer Press's special section on Sunday about the future of the Minnesota economy. And, of course, we're talking about all this in the context of the Summit on Minnesota's Economy, which is going on today in downtown St. Paul, and we will have more from the summit after the noon hour here, when we hear from some of the speakers at the conference this morning.
Hi, this is Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you've been overwhelmed by the selection at your local farmer's market and then have to figure out what to do with the food once you get it home, the Splendid Table might be able to help. Visit www.splendidtable.org for our slideshow of our own local farmer's market, suggestions for selecting fresh produce, and my recipe for a great Italian bread salad. Online at www.splendidtable.org.
And now, Garrison Keillor and the Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, September the 20th, 2000. It's the birthday of actress Sophia Loren, born Sophia Ciccolone in Rome, 1934. She grew up poor in Naples after the war. She was nicknamed Stichetto, the stick, for being so skinny. When she was not quite 15, she entered a beauty contest at which one of the judges was the film producer Carlo Ponti, who sent her to drama coaches, put her in films, and then, when she was older, he married her. It's the birthday of poet Donald Hall, born in New Haven, Connecticut, 1928, poet laureate of New Hampshire now, where he lives on Eagle Pond Farm, bought by his great-grandfather in 1865. Author of many collections of poetry, Exiles and Marriages, The Museum of Clear Ideas, and his most recent, Without, poems written to and for his wife, poet Jane Kenyon, who died in 1995. It's the birthday of the English poet Stevie Smith, born Florence Margaret Smith in Hull, Yorkshire, in 1902. Who wrote novels, made many comic drawings, but is remembered most for her poetry. It's the birthday of the editor Maxwell Perkins, born in New York City, 1884,
who in 1920 persuaded his fellow editors at Scribner's to publish F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel This Side of Paradise, which had already been rejected twice by the House. He also was a promoter of Ring Lardner, Ernest Hemingway, and Thomas Wolfe. It's the birthday of the novelist Upton Sinclair, born in Baltimore, 1878, wrote many novels, of which The Jungle was his most popular. It was about the immigrant workers in the meatpacking industry in Chicago. But instead of arousing sympathy for the workers, as Sinclair hoped, it aroused anger at the impurities in processed meats and led to the passage of federal food inspection laws. Sinclair said, "I aimed at the public's heart, and by accident I hit it in the stomach." It's the anniversary of the first day of the financial panic of 1873, which was set off by the failure of Jay Cook and his finance company, which had sunk money into the Northern Pacific Railroad. There was a banking panic. The New York Stock Exchange was forced to close for the first time in its history, and it brought on an economic slump that lasted for 6 years. And it was on this day in 1580, Sir Francis Drake made landfall in Plymouth, England, the first captain to sail around the world. On his way home, he'd captured tons of treasure from Spanish galleons in the Americas. Spain considered him a pirate. The English considered him a hero. He had left England 3 years before with five small ships. The Golden Hind was the only one to make it through the Straits of Magellan and reach the Pacific. Here's a poem by Donald Hall on his birthday, a poem entitled Eleanor's Letters. I who picked up the neat old letters never knew the last names to complete Aunt Eleanor or Lou. She talked about the weather and canning and a trip which they might take together if we don't lose our grip. But Lou has got a growth which might turn out, they say, benign or shrink or both. Then Louis passed away. He didn't die. That word seemed harsh and arbitrary, and thus was not preferred in her vocabulary. Everything's for the better, she wrote, and what is more, she signed her dying letter, as ever, Eleanor. A poem by Donald Hall, Eleanor's Letters, from Old and New Poems, published by Tickner and Fields, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, September 20th. Made possible by 21NorthMain.com, where book lovers find more than 12 million used, rare, and antiquarian books on the web at 21NorthMain.com. Research by Richard Mosher and Brian.